I've just said that I've fallen off a little bit with Lucifer. Because of accounts. After what you told us over the last few weeks,
yeah,
it doesn't seem to be necessary at all. Because we're either moving inwards or outwards. We're either moving to the perimeter where we have the sorties, or we're moving to the centre where there are no sorties.
Yeah.
If I call the perimeter with the sorties Lucifer,
yeah,
I'm only adding something to it that's unnecessary. I'm either moving inwards or outwards, and we don't need Lucifer. That's the thing I've been thinking of.
Well, that is the final metaphysical truth. You don't need him. Well, supposing you had a pocket full of money, then you wouldn't need any money, would you?
No.
And if you had a stomach full of food, you wouldn't need any food.
No.
And because you've got a perimeter with teeth, I mean, you don't need one. Because needing implies lack, doesn't it? Now, if we didn't have him, we wouldn't need him. If you were a non-existential being, absolutely, it would be a fiction.
That's what he looks like to me.
A fiction? Well, many philosophers have charged him with being a fiction. And he is a fiction, but first you have to define fiction. So when you talk about necessary and so on, you must define it. Necessity has something to do with essence, hasn't it?
Yeah. Well, I also mentioned that in the Bible it said God created the world, the universe. Now, if I take that to be the physical universe, the material of the universe, the earth and the planets and so forth, how can they be Lucifer? If God created Lucifer and then he became the material world, it's a sort of second-hand creation, isn't it?
Second-hand is the word that the Gnostics and various other philosophers have used of it. They use the word demiurge for the creator, which is second-hand. The half-worker, because he only works half of it, namely the gross material half. The thoughts you're having are valid thoughts, and very ancient ones, philosophically.
Well, it looks to me as though it's like looking at the stick, at one end or the other.
Mm-hmm. If you cut one end up, you've still got two ends, haven't you?
Yes, but I don't have to have a third thing introduced, or a third idea, when there are only two.
And what are the two?
Well, one is the in and the other is the out. One's the centre and one's the perimeter.
Here's the universe itself. And it's caused by a force or energy, spirit, rotating, isn't it? And that is the limit. This circle represents the great universe of which there is no bigger. Now, obviously this one has no teeth on the outside. Aristotle calls that one the motionless mover. It's motionless because there's nothing outside it to relate its motion to. So that all relative motion is inside it. So if we draw three circles inside here, we can see the possibility of relative motion in these three, can't we? We can also see a very strange thing. Supposing that is the direction of rotation in those three circles, it follows that where that one, you see, meets that one, they're kicking against each other, aren't they?
Yeah.
Hmm? And it's there where the kick is that these serrations occur, isn't it? They can't occur here, on the outside of the macrocosmos. They must occur on any being inside the macrocosmos. The great universe doesn't have any on the outside, but it has them on the inside here. And it's because of the pulsation of that great sphere that these internal spheres rotate. You know, if you've got a ball inside your fingers and knock it together like this with your fingers, then the ball will start to rotate, won't it?
Yeah.
Because you cannot get those pressures internally and externally exactly equal. And the inequality will kick the ball and it will begin to rotate. And we call this big one the motionless mover, because there's nothing relative to it outside to measure its motion if it had any. And also, it doesn't have to turn to make these things rotate, it can just pulse. And then all the spheres inside rotate. I'm going to take two of these out to simplify this. Suppose I'm going to say there's the direction of motion, they're both going the same way. And at this point, they will kick against each other, won't they? So they must drive each other apart. And funnily enough, if you get two sets and they drive each other apart, the direction of rotation is like that, look. So that, imagine that this is a surface view of water, and these are two vortices, one there and one there. This one must be kicking the water here, hasn't it? This way, and turning it backwards, mustn't it?
Yeah.
And the one there must be kicking it that way, and therefore turning it the same way. Now that's the same thing that an engineer calls an idler, isn't it?
Yes.
Now that idler is necessary. This is a very important concept. These two, because they're going the same way around, must kick against each other. And once they've separated, they start an idling process between them in universal substance. Actually, this is the same thing in between the volition and the ideation. You've got an idler, yeah, which is actually kicked round in the opposite direction and serves as the balancer and the spacer which enables the other two to rotate in the same way. Now, in this case, we've got three hierarchies of angels. Angels and angles are the same. These are the three great hierarchies of God. And again, they kick against each other. So they must push against each other and introduce idlers. So we'll cut that down from that and put one in here. We'll have to cut that one down. And then we get our six circles inside one, don't we?
Yes.
Now, if that one belongs to that one, then those three are idlers, aren't they? We'll mark them off. Now, supposing we take God the Father, and the Son, and the Holy Ghost, like we said before, the power, the form, and the operation, between those two, and those two, there must be an idler. Now, this Trinity belongs in eternity. And this one is the time world. And opposite to the Father is this concept of the Luciferian figure, which makes it possible for the Son of Man, that is incarnated Christ, to appear. Now let's just think about that diagram a moment and realize that the mere fact that we can make a relation presupposes a triangle. To make a relation, we have two terms, two objects, and something in common with both of them, don't we?
Yeah.
And we can't have a relation without that. Two separate things with something that they have between them, in common. So we would say in this case that God the Father is power, the Son is power, and the Ghost is power. That is power initiating, that is power rotating and therefore forming. This is power arranging the rotating forms. So, the relating factor there, the substantial concept, would be power. And we can't have a relation without two terms. And there must be something there between them. If we take the subject and the predicate, we always have a verb in between, which in logic is called the copula, the joiner. We can't say SP, which isn't a statement. We must say S is P or S is not P, when is not can be linked together or is not P. Some logicians prefer to say S is not P in some cases, and some prefer to say S is not P. But we can't do it without this copula. And this copula is some form of the verb to be. Because being, substantial being, is the ground of all our statement. Something must exist in order for us to speak about it. We're going back, okay? Let's have a look at this question of the necessity of anything whatever. If we take a triangle, we can say that it necessarily has three sides, can't we? And everybody popularly would use the word necessary to mean that. That if you remove from a thing what constitutes that thing's essence, you have moved that which is necessary for its existence. So if you remove the rational part of a human being, take out his brain, for instance, fillet him, take his nervous system away, you wouldn't call him a human being anymore, would you?
No.
There's something essential there. If the essential is there, then that being is there. And if it is taken away, it isn't that being, it's another one. So necessary has to do with essence. In fact, we could make it into two words. You see, that SA is part of the verb to be, isn't it? It's the same as essence, you see. Ness. Now that's not ceasing, isn't it? Arising. So the necessary is that which cannot cease. If it does cease, it isn't that being anymore. If you get an egg before it's broken, and it has a certain shape, and then you break the shell, take it out, make it into an omelette. Well, then it's not egg-shaped anymore, is it?
No.
If by egg-shape you mean the shape like this, more or less elliptical shape.
Yeah.
Hmm? So, the essence of a thing is that which, if it ceases, the thing itself will cease. Is that clear?
Yes.
Now we'll consider just precisely what this serration business is. And then we can see whether, if we remove it, we will remove all that we call value. We'll draw the saw teeth again, on the plane back to the saw. We can count here, and here we can't. Now, the essence of this side is precisely that it is toothed. The essence of this side is that it is plain. That's discrete, that's continuous. Now let's look at the concept of value. The letter V is a snake's tongue or a plant splitting. You see? When we talk about value, we're talking about something you can get something out of. If we talk about utilitarian value, the value of this thing is that it makes black marks. It is there, I drag it along the paper, a black mark appears. That black mark has been got out of this pencil, hasn't it?
Yes.
So, we say that its capacity for making black marks is in it. We know actually that it is its substance we've scraped onto the paper, isn't it? The value of that thing is precisely its substance, which has certain qualities.
Yeah.
Draw two V's, put a beam across, put two pans in the bottom, and we've got the symbol of value, haven't we? The evaluator, scales. Now the scale is so called because if you want to be really fine, scrupulous as we say, weigh with the scales of a fish. They're very light. And you know that all the early trade of the world was in terms of very expensive things. Kings used to send precious stones, gold, marvellous perfumes, and they weighed it with the scales of a fish. That's being really scrupulous, isn't it? So, here we have the symbol of value and the symbol of time, T. And it's on this basis that we weigh all that we consider worthy of our attention. And the idea here is that there are discrete things. Because we cannot evaluate unless we've got two. Can we? There must be discretion in order to have value. There's no value in this thing here. You see? Remove all the teeth and this is useless. Remove all differences, whatever, and the whole universe has disappeared. And we've said that the necessary is that which does not cease. And if we can show that something cannot cease, we have shown that that thing is an eternal necessity. Now, value means this weighing process and implies a duality of objects and a common point which joins them, their substantial origin. So, if we call this side of the soul Lucifer, or the intellectual side, we can see, if we write intellect on there, we can write down here feeling, can't we? We mustn't even call it volition at this point, because volition, will, is the point of initiation of a change. And there is no change in the continuous. We can call it feeling, we can call it sentiency, field awareness, but we must not call it anything suggesting for a moment value. Value implies a difference. So the value side is here, the differential side. Is that clear?
Yes.
Now, let's draw our circle as we did before. And this is a finite one within the universe, and therefore its perimeter is serrated, like a circular saw. Inside him he has the immanent spirit, his isness, his eternality. And here is the part where he was stimulated by other externals. And your thought was that maybe this is not necessary, because there is going in and coming out all the way around, isn't it?
Not that that was not necessary, but it was not necessary to call it Lucifer.
Well,
I'm not trying to lose the thought, I'm trying to lose Lucifer.
Oh, well, let's have a look very carefully at what Lucifer is. Light, fire. See? Lucifer is light, fire. Already there's a dual aspected being there. This fair is the same as those teeth. This loose is the same as that is. This is the great secret about the devil, that the devil and God are fundamentally identical. Because this is the centre from which arises the light, which radiates. That's the Lucy. And those teeth there are the fer, or friction zone, where another one touches it. So really Lucifer refers to the whole process. Now historically, we're up against the fact that when it was known that Lucifer was the whole process, it was the peculiar possession of a few people who were ruling society. And in order to make other people obey them, they had to hide the fact that it's all the same whether you go in or out. As long as you're exercising your light and your fire or energy. You can't get people to obey you passively if you first educate them to believe that there's an inner principle of intelligence and energy in themselves that has no need of external direction. You see that?
Yes.
This Lucifer, we can write it rightly, looks the light and the fire, or fair, which is the same as the I am there, but between the two, you see, is this idling zone. Between the light and the fire, consciousness and energy, the universe itself rotates.
I can see that as a principle.
That is the meaning of this name. We mustn't throw away a name and retain the meaning of the name and then think we've got rid of something. This ancient name of him is one of the names conferred on the same being. Another one, of course, is Beelzebub, which means Lord of the Flies, because all the petty irritations along there considered as little ineffectual stimuli are called flies, and he is the lord of those because he's the lord of all stimulation whatever. Friedrich Nietzsche borrows this idea when he talks about the flies in the marketplace, meaning that whenever people are exchanging goods they irritate each other all the time and to no real being value. They haggle and bargain when they know already that the price is going down. You see? That flies in the marketplace. They're not wasps or bees. They don't sting each other. They just threaten each other, and both sides know that the other is only threatening and cannot do anything about it. So that kind of thing, that process of petty irritations, is called Beelzebub. The Zebub itself in it is an onomatopoeic word, just copying the noise of a lot of flies. And Baal simply means itself the house of that worker. As a matter of fact, the word Albar is Baal. Turn round. The Baal in the Euphrates Valley is the Albar of this island, Perfidius Albion. And still the name for Scotland in the Celtic language is Alba. White. White means balanced. Another of his titles is Satan, isn't it? And Satan means the serpent, the cross on which he is fixed, and the continuity principle, N, which means continuity. And this is the self-crucified one, because he does it on himself. Now, every organized state, every national state, every church state, in order to maintain its position as dispenser of doctrine or dispenser of orders, must teach everybody their dependence on the government, either the earthly government or the spiritual government, must teach dependence. It therefore must define that any person who crucifies himself on his own idea is a heretic. Heretic actually means, is a Greek word which in its root means, I think for myself. Now orthodoxy is, doxa is opinion, ortho is that Torah root again, it means right, it simply means the law. Orthodox means opinion, right. The right opinion. Now what is an opinion? If I want to build a big church, then I would say those opinions are valid and orthodox, which put one brick on another up to the height I require. Because fundamentally the cause is in will. Somebody's willing to build something. And they must define Satan and Lucifer and Beelzebub and any one of the other thousands of titles of that self-sufficient fellow as a nuisance and a devil. And remember what we said before, that word devil, Dave, you, if you look in Hobbes' Leviathan, we find he's spelling it this way, devil. And the Irish still say divil for devil, because it isn't just an Irish accent, but it is divil. In the 18th century it was written that way. Now div is God. And this is God. L is the same as L, Al. And this is the root to see. Divide, videre to see. This is divide root, the tooth side. This is the sea root, which you can't do unless there are things to be seen, belonging on the tooth side. And this is the link side, here. So that's the continuity principle, and that's the discrete principle. So the devil is God. This is why the rabbi said to Christ, when he was tearing their orthodoxy to bits, "Ah, he hath the devil." Now, we know that if we go into Persia and northern India, we find exactly the same word there, div, div. That's Sanskrit, that's Persian. And they're adjacent countries, and they are taught by the government there that div means bad, and they're taught it means good. So the people on the perimeter there, when they meet each other, these people will say, those people over there openly admit that they worship Div. And these people will say, those people over there say that what we worship is bad. And it was the ancient method of keeping people round the centres of commerce, what we call today the direction of labour. The Egyptians used to teach that the earth was flat, the Indians did the same, usually a big ring of mountains round it. And if you still had enough courage to go over those, there was nothing on the other side. It was a bottomless abyss. And if you didn't care about abysses, down below there was a monster, Typhon, waiting to swallow you. The Indians made it very difficult for you because they put the world like a disc, mountains around it, put it on the back of an elephant, made the elephant stand on a tortoise, made the tortoise swim in an infinite ocean. You might as well stay where you are. You say that you're directing labour. So, whatever we do, we have to accept this. There's no value unless we see the discrete, the differential. And yet, we can't see it except a background of sameness. There must be a difference, and there must be something same underneath. The same is Zama, seed, the source, the potential. So this is the potential side, down there, potentiality. And at the top here is actuality. So you see, all our actuality is on our outside. And our potentiality is tucked on the inside. What we do is take some of our potentials and actualize them. And then, using the actuality, we find ourselves presented with further stimuli, which are, in fact, incoming energies. And we take them in and store them in our potential department until we're ready to come out again. Now we've said that necessity is that which does not cease. And if a thing can cease, it is not absolutely necessary. Now the nature of this says that there is a logical relation between the teeth and the non-teeth, between the serrated side of the saw and the plain side. Because if we didn't have that substantial piece of metal there, both of those would be meaningless. So there are two aspects of substance. The one, the continuous plain aspect, valueless, and the value side, the truth side. And we see those values against this plain background. Thus, protective colouring in animals, say the dappling of fawns or something, against similar patterns in light and shade in the undergrowth, makes it impossible to see it. So we need a plain background to see the differences. Both are necessary. If all plain, we can't see plain, we wouldn't even exist because we're already differentiated. So what all men call value rests on those two. A fundamental sameness, which is the substantial ground, and an actual differentiation, which is the value that we see. And it doesn't matter if we call it Lucifer or Satan or Beelzebub or a variety of names. There are lots of names in different languages. But they're all meanings gathered together in the simple fact that we're talking always about this sameness of the universe, our source, which is essentially identical, and the differential side of our nature that makes it possible to have a conversation. If we weren't differentiated, we couldn't have a conversation. There is no conversation in the continuous. So we mustn't think that we've done anything if we throw away a term that means exactly the right thing. What we ought to do is understand the term.
Understood the term before, because what you've shown me now, I can follow, and that is logical. But to think of Lucifer as
A person,
yeah,
but he is a person. Let's consider
that's the part that's difficult for me. I can see all the reasoning of that.
Yes.
As I said before, when the created outside and the savings at the centre, I can see all that and what is meant by it. But when I've got to think of Lucifer as a being who influenced things in the beginning and created the soul piece, when it tells me in the Bible that God made the soul piece, that's the part that gets a bit confused.
No, you see, it depends how you read Genesis. It says, in the beginning, the earth was without form and void, doesn't it?
Yes, well, I'm thinking of the physical universe, and if the soul piece are Lucifer, all of the physical universe must be Lucifer.
That's what the Bible says.
Well,
the whole world is in the grip of the devil. Created means locked up. You've forgotten that the Kra root, you see, that create, is Ark. Now, God did not Ark nothing. He didn't lock nothing up, he locked something up.
Yes, but he made the universe. He didn't create another person or another being and say, you can do it if you like. And the other one did it.
You know that you're indulging in abstract thinking and you don't even notice it. Because the universe itself is a modal operation inside absolute sentiency. The essential attributes of the absolute are these. It must be, mustn't it? And it must see, which is consciousness. We call it awareness. It must be aware. And it must move, have motion. Yes? It must be aware of its own motion, mustn't it?
Yes.
Now, we cannot deny one of these three to it. If we put the Sanskrit word in, sat is being, chit, awareness, and ananda, which actually means a serpent running along, is the motion. Those are the three. And you must not suddenly remove one. Now let this paper again, the white paper, represent the absolute of three aspects. So that the absolute is being aware of the motion which it itself is doing. Is that clear?
Yes.
And when we make a circle like this, we haven't touched that inside, have we?
No.
So that's still being aware of its own motion, isn't it? So it must be aware of its perimeter rotation, mustn't it? This must be aware that there's something there. This must be aware that there's something there. This one is aware that it's finite. This one is aware that it is infinite with a finite in it.
Yes.
Hmm?
Yes.
Right, now the Pirasam, or rotating sonic system, has these three aspects. It is aware of its own motion, which is precisely what a person is. A person is not a fellow with legs and arms. A person is simply a being who is aware of his own motion. Remember Grenfell of Labrador, in a little book on the physiology for children he wrote, said that a man in India, involved in a railway crash, who lost both his legs and arms, was considered by his family no longer to be a person. So they came and took all his furniture away. So he then brought legal action against them. And Grenfell says, when he was in the court, he could still say he was he, in spite of the fact that he had no legs and arms. Therefore, he was still essentially human. And the court ordered the return of all the things. He could still say he was he. He was a being, and he was aware of his own motion or action.
Yeah.
Now that is the definition of a person. Now, it is quite abstract thinking to suddenly remove, like a physical scientist does, the sentience, this awareness of the absolute sentience. The universe itself is a sentience being with modifications inside it, some of which we call thought, some which we call feeling, some which we call physical bodies, these things. But we only know a physical body by resistance, by being aware that we can't get through something when we try. The physical universe is a system of resistances inside an awareness being. Isn't it?
Yes.
So the universe itself is a person. Because it fulfills the definition. It is a sentient being, moving, aware of its own motion, and knowing that it is. All this it feels, and it feels some total formal content of its own being. That's a person. This is why Christ, before the appearance in the time process, is still called a person, the second person of the Trinity. You see, the cosmic Christ is not less, but more of a person than a finite man is. Because to become more of a person is simply to become more aware. Awake, for morning in the bowl of night has flung the stone that puts the stars to flight. That awake is the command right to every religion, wake up. Become aware of what motions are in your being. When you know yourself, you are increasing in your personal being. You're becoming more and more of a person, the more you know about yourself. So, Christ Logos, the universal being, is actually the fully personality. He's not vague. We're vague. He's not vague. He has internal to him, in his awareness, every thought that we've got as individuals. He's got the thoughts of all people. Not only today existent, but all the people who have lived and died and had memories, those are his. And all the people who may come to be now resident in the germplasm of existent human beings, all those thoughts and the memories in the plasm are also his, and he knows it. He's a person. Now that same person, from two different points of view, is God and the devil. He's a devil to all opinionated orthodox system makers, because he breaks them down, ultimately. But he also builds them up because they're convenient at a certain period. See, when the Roman Empire fell flat, the Goths came in and knocked it down. There was no unity principle. And there was absolutely no authority to take its place other than the Christian Church at that time, which was a baby. And because there was no authority, a man like Augustine, who was a tremendously ambitious and powerful man, intelligent and ambitious, Lucian fair, he moved in and began to define the city of God and the city of the opposition. And it was simply this, that there was no authority there, there was chaos among human beings, and therefore a necessity. Something must come to be in time, because it is an eternal fact that the serrated and the continuous are both logically presupposed in each other. Therefore, the Church became valid at that moment as a unifying principle. And it remained valid up to the time that other centres had enough coordination to rule themselves. And then the Roman hierarchical structures became invalid. The great revolt started. And the spirit bloweth where it listeth. So it blew into Luther. And it blew into Henry. That spirit blows into a form and animates it. And then it leads it. Supposing somebody comes along and you give him a lupin seed. And he says, there's a lupin in there. And he says, good, good, I love lupins. And he puts it in a drawer. And says, I've got a lupin. I think, well, it doesn't look like one, does it? But it is one, you know. It's potentially the most beautiful lupin there ever was. Well, I'm going to put it in the garden. No, I'm going to keep it there. Now, God says, I don't like that fellow. He ought to put it in the garden. Let it grow. The man says, please, sir, if I put it in the garden, it'll grow and it'll wither. And God says, everything has to wither. If you don't put that seed out of that dark drawer and put it in the garden and let it grow, I personally will disintegrate it with cosmic radiation. I'll have a go at it. I'll knock it to bits. I'll let moth and dust get at it. Corruption will get at it because you're not using it. So we've got to see this whole system as within this great being, which is God, and the devil. It's the God, the good, the supreme good to all beings who are prepared to let go of a thing when its utility is finished. It is the devil to all the people who want to hang on to a thing when its time has gone.
Well, in the case of Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden,
yeah,
when Eve was tempted by the serpent, serpent was Satan, or the devil, or Lucifer.
Yeah.
But it's not literally a serpent. The thing that tempted them was the fact that they liked the saw-teeth edge.
But that is the serpent.
Because they like it, the saw-teeth
edge. It's a serration pent. A serrated thought. You see, when Christ says, be careful how you take the words in that book. Those words are spirit and they are life, properly understood. That thing that goes on the ground that we call a serpent, that is a particularized serpent. The universal serpent is just as conscious as all serpents together, and that wiggling like this is the basis of the sore teeth. And we call that thing a serpent because it goes like this, like those teeth. And it's possible to count the wiggles in him. But if you straighten him out, you can only say one. You see?
Yes, I see?
And it's a sentient being, and the universal being is a serpent too. The oldest image of God that we've got is a serpent, with his tail in his mouth, biting himself, and saying, I've been bitten, and biting back. You see? And that's the rotation of the stimulation in the universe. Really, that's all that's got to be learned, is that every individual, without knowing it, is his own serpent, bites himself in the tail, and complains. In other words, self-stimulation is going on through fantasy. The universal serpent is just as conscious as all serpents together, and that wiggling like this is the basis of the sore teeth. And we call that thing a serpent because he goes like this, like those teeth. And it's possible to count the wiggles in him. But if you straighten him out, you can only say one. You see? And it's a sentient being, and the universal being is a serpent too. The oldest image of God that we've got is a serpent, with his tail in his mouth, biting himself, and saying, I've been bitten, and biting back. You see? And that's the rotation of the stimulation in the universe. Really, that's all that's got to be learned, is that every individual, without knowing it, is his own serpent, bites himself in the tail, and complains. In other words, self-stimulation is going on through fantasy. Man thinks, and he may think that Johnny so-and-so said a rude word to me last week and I should get my hand back on him. He may think so. He is stimulating himself. He will get the results of his own self-stimulation. As he sows, so is he going to reap. You know, one of our best thinkers, one of our most insulted modern thinkers, probably one of the most misunderstood Frenchmen of modern times, said, it is no good trying to simplify the truth so that the football crowd will like it. What we've got to do is find the people who would like to hear the truth as it is. Don't throw the terms away. The terms are valid. When we talk about Saturn and Jupiter, they are valid terms. They need understanding. They don't want thrown away. There's nothing you can put in its place. Suppose you say, well, Saturn only means contraction, and Jupiter only means expansion. That isn't true. Saturn means a will to contract. It sentiences it. To pretend that it's merely contraction is abstract thinking, because there is no contraction in the universe other than this willing towards centres. And Saturn means also this sentient covetousness, this pressing on centres. Jupiter means the will to move away from centres, to expand. So if we say it is merely, as Isaac Newton said, expansion and contraction, that's abstract thinking. It isn't really concretely true. Newton took the thought out of Joachim Blume's works that contraction and expansion in opposition produce rotation. Now, when Joachim Blume is using those terms, he talks about the contraction, about the compunction, and in the same sentence about the anger and the furious covetousness of Saturn. Now, Newton did not disbelieve that, but he knew that he was living in a period where it would not be acceptable. It would be anachronistic to talk about the will of universal substance contracting. So he said, I will take out the contraction and use that alone, and the expansion and use that alone, and the rotation and use that alone, and say that rotation is a product of contraction and expansion. In other words, Jupiter and Saturn, God and the devil, produce Mercury, or the sun, between them, rotation. Now, Isaac Newton did that, and his notebooks exist, in which he made notes from Joachim Blume. And this infuriates many of the scientists, because they say, well, he must have had a silly side as well as a clear side. Bernard Shaw once made a stupid statement about him, and he said that he was obviously mad. He was trying to translate the book of Joshua into mathematics. So he must have been insane. Actually, it's shot through with mathematical formula.
The book of Joshua?
You see, if you remember that the Hebrews had no way of counting other than the letters of the alphabet, if they wrote the letter A, You see, which is an L off like that. Looks a bit like an A. And the letter B, which is like that. Now, A plus B equals C in English. The third letter in Hebrew is G. That is the same letter and lock, but the other one, because the Hebrews as a people were grossly materialistic, they said we'll have gross matter there, G, and their sign for it is there. So, Aleph plus Beth equals Gimel. 1 plus 2 equals 3. But Aleph and Beth mean Abba, the Father, title of God. The first in the house. Beth is Hebrew for the house. The first Aleph in the house is a camel. Now, Aleph means an ox, the principle of acceptance. If you don't accept circumscription, you will never become a self-subsistent being. 1 plus 2 equals 3. Now, our 3, written like that, you see this partition. There's our 3 points of the relation. And if we go like this, you can see a kind of arcane candlestick. That's 1, 3. The 3 in the 1, the Trinity. And if you look at it very carefully, and we'll draw it a little more like this, and put the end on it, it's simply the male organ. The 1, 3. The one which is really 3. Alistair Crowley thought, well, my name begins Alistair, so I'll write it like that. And that's how he used to sign all his documents. Because he knew perfectly well that the universe itself has 2 aspects here, potential, and an activator. You see, there's a difference between the left and the right content. One is loaded with form, one is loaded with will, as a stress. This is an ovipositor, if you like. That's simply a mode of depositing eggs into a bed, isn't it? And they are kept here, and they differ on this side and this, like the teeth and the continuous, or like boys and girls. And that is the old symbol which appears here in the Trinity, which is A plus B equals C. Now, the first converts to Christianity were Jews. And they were converted because of a very simple thing. They were taught that the Lord thy God is one God. They believed that God was only one. And Christianity said that God was 3 in 1. And the Jews said, no, God is merely one, which is to say, just continuous without any difference. And the early Jews were converted, those who were really knowledgeable, by simply telling them Aleph plus Bet equals Gimel. That is, AB, the father, is a camel. Because the camel is, by the symbol of its hump, self-sufficient. It maintains itself in the desert. In the vast infinite, there is a camel in the universe. A camel is so called, not because it's got legs, but because it's got a hump. Because it stores things. So you see, what we have to do is penetrate to the meaning of the words that have come down to us traditionally. Get right down to it. Don't throw out the baby with the bathwater. Get hold of the real meaning of the word and don't eliminate it. And you shouldn't eliminate it because of this reason. You have to think in terms of form. You can either think visually, or you can think audibly with words. Whichever you do, you are thinking in terms of form, because the words you employ are merely quickly said visual images, which once upon a time were drawings of actual objects. The alphabet derives from a hieroglyphic background. So you have to think either with words or visual images. So to throw one away is to throw away a tool of thought. And we mustn't omit to remind ourselves all the time that the universe itself is a one turn inside infinite sentiency. There's a substantial awareness there that knows everything that is going on inside it. When it says God is not mocked, it means this. Every little finite being is inside this infinite ocean of awareness, this eternal moving awareness being. So that if you do something that he doesn't like, you can't win. And it's not in a hurry, it just shuffles you into your next lesson. Because it's got plenty of other people who need precisely the kind of lesson that you'll give to them while they're giving you one. You see, the man that moves out of a job because he's uncomfortable there and doesn't like so-and-so and goes to another job finds it's another kind of thing that he annoys and annoys him. There's nowhere where you can move negatively that is an attempt to get away from fact without precipitating yourself into an equivalent disguised. You see, this idea of God and the devil, the word devil is simply the word God, with a nasty aroma around it put there by the church, because they cannot make an organized body if they teach people independence. Autonomous centers don't go to church. They are a church. The temple of God is with man. Every Christian, that is everyone who understands the real relations of the crossing the circle, is himself a priest. And he has the power, if you understand it, to bind and loose. That is to tie up and define and to undefine. And it means tying people up if they don't know. Because in fact you can define an idea for somebody, and if they don't know how to get out of it, your definition will bind them. And they can be circumscribed with their own idea, and you can undo it whether they like it or not. When Socrates went about stinging the slow-moving horse of the Greek state into motion, the government didn't like it. The young men did, they loved it. But the government didn't like it. And so they said, if you go on undefining our definitions like this, there'll be no state left. So they asked him to drink the hemlock, which is the same thing as drink the shut up. Because the H and the M and the lock signify the spirit and the matter. So really, Socrates was letting the cat out of the bag. You remember what happened when he went to the Delphic Oracle, and the Oracle said to him, you are the man in Greece who knows the most, you're the wisest man in Greece. And he said, that's very strange, the Oracle cannot tell a lie and I don't know anything. And then he thought, well, I do know this, that I know nothing. Maybe that's more than other people know. So he went off to a politician and said, are you a politician? The man said, yes. What do you know about politics? Said he. So the man began to tell him. Socrates cross-questioned him, because he knew that S and P just don't fit, and that every P is taken out of S and can't be put back again without some mysterious thing in S that is not in P. So the predicates, no matter how many you make, can never exhaust the subject. So he just exhausted them, and they being finite, couldn't go on infinitely. And if they could have done, he just stood there listening, delighted. And so they flew into a temper. And after he'd annoyed all the chief leaders, he then said to them, apparently the oracle was right, I know more than you do, because I know I don't know and you don't. So they then decided, we'll have to put him on the spot. But he was 70 before they finally nailed him. And in his own words, he couldn't possibly go and walk to another country, because he would have to start talking there, so he might as well drink the hemlock here. You see, if we get these universal symbols right, this H is the aspirate letter, isn't it? It's just simply breath. What is it? It's the least solid thing that we have that we can get hold of in our body, isn't it? And yet, strangely enough, if we cut it off, we die. We take the most solid part, our bone, saw our nice thigh bone off, you see, we don't die. We can heal it up. Cut the breath off, that very fine, subtle substance and we die. So that age, the aspirate, represents that fine, subtle essential in us. And we find, in fact, that in the universe, the most subtle is the most important. And the most gross is the least important for intelligent people. And for unintelligent people, the opposite. The more the stress is on the gross world, the less intelligence there is in a person. As Francis Williams and some other journalistic experts talking to a big fellow who made a few million pounds, and they were greedy to get at it. But he wasn't interested in money. And when they said to him, it must have been the first £100,000 that was difficult to make, how did you do that? Surely that was harder than the other. And he said, no, it was just as easy. And they couldn't get out of him the secret. And the real secret was that he wasn't interested in money, he was only interested in power. Power makes money, it isn't money that makes power. Nouveau-Riche tried to climb into the aristocracy with money, never got there. Because there's something more than that coinage that's dug out of the ground, namely the fellow who fabricated, a fellow named Joseph, who fabricated the concept of coinage as a means of tying up other people's power by forcing them into the intellect, the counting department, out of the will. If you train people to count, then you can tie up their volition in worry processes. You see, the pure man of will goes about in a free state before civilization exists. He does what he wants. Another man wants to build a pyramid, and he goes to this wild man and says, build a pyramid. And he says, what for? Well, it's a monument. To what? To my importance. Oh. And he goes away. He's no good, you see. So what you have to do is get some fairly young ones and teach them that there is a method of counting. Now you teach them all about the teeth, but you don't tell them that those teeth belong to the back of the saw. Because if you push the back of the saw right up mentally, you'll find that the teeth are on the back of the saw. Where does the back of the saw start? So then you start teaching the three R's, or three records, which Luther inserted instead of the great dogma of the church. And that throws the child into intellectual centres. And the intellectual centre is a negative controlling centre on the will. So you set up a series of forms. Today we call it conditioning their reflexes. You set a series of forms in their mind such that their will cannot operate without first filtering through the trained system. Then you can say to them, now boys, forward, we're going to build a new bridge. And they respond because they've been conditioned. And this is an actual historical process that was fabricated. The biblical story of the fabricator is the story of Joseph. Remember what Joseph did? When Joseph goes to Egypt, every Egyptian at that time owned his own patch of land. And he said to Pharaoh, these fellows here, you know, they're no good to you, they're independent. Each man has got his own bit of land. And every year the Nile flooded, and then every man marked out his own land. And sometimes a bit of a fight. So Joseph said, I've got an idea whereby we can take all their land off them and get them to work for us, but it will take a bit of time. But he outlined the idea to Pharaoh, and Pharaoh said, well, that's very good. As from today's date, let every man bow to you as if you were me. So when Joseph went out in the chariot, they said, he is the fellow like Pharaoh. He was really Pharaoh's left-hand man. Now, what he did was this, a very, very simple trick. He said, according to the Chaldean astrology handed down to him from his ancestors, the whole universe itself is cyclic, and there must come times of dearth and times of plenty in the harvest. So what we will do is wait for a time of plenty, and then people will be so delighted and so careless, we will impose a tax of corn. And then we'll collect the corn. And they won't mind because there's plenty. They throw it away. and would store it, and we would wait for the time of dearth. So he built big granaries, and then when there was plenty, those fat kind, you know, they stored all the grain in the granaries, and the people didn't care, there was plenty of it. But he knew the cyclic law. So at the end of the cycle of plenty, dearth came in, and Egypt became the granary of a starving world. And when the people said, "We have no corn to make bread," Joseph said, "Well, you bring me your cattle, and I will give you some corn." So he got the cattle, and the dearth went on. The next year they were still short of corn. So he said, "All right, now you give me your land and your labor, and I will give you corn." And so they had to agree. And then the moment the land was officially his, that is to say they had agreed, he moved all the people from the south to the north, and all the people from the north to the south. So the whole thing was beautifully balanced, and Joseph was highly rewarded for that. And as a matter of fact, Joseph is still one of the chief study figures if you do a history of economy. You see? Because he actually fabricated this whole system of land steaming, coinage fabrication. You know, they still print in Irish coinage a pig and a hen and so on. In the old days, they used to print corn on it, you see. And the great password, the shibboleth, as we say, meaning plenty, is a sheaf of corn. And that corn, sometimes we say somebody's being corny. And that is a survival from the same thing. In the church you have a screen behind which certain mysteries go on. In the German language you have a word harfen, to harp. Secondary meaning to screen the corn. Now corn and the corn of the room are related because corn in a one-room dwelling used to be kept in the corner. And the corner was called corner because he put the corn in it. And then they used to put a harp over it. If anybody came to borrow corn, your wife started playing the harp. You said, "What did you say?" "You never put the corn. Come here for this harp." You see? Hence harpen, to screen the corn. Now, this whole technique is traditional. It has been handed down, and is still used in propaganda. And, of course, advertising is riddled with it. It touches you on fundamentals. And if you're not on guard, you are triggered off by a million memories you know nothing about. I brought a little diagram which had a wonderful adventure. It blew out of the car and went into a puddle in Liverpool, and has since been dried out. To show you the analysis of a man, Carl Jung. And to show how this analysis obscures as much as it reveals. Just stand up and try. Is that visible now? Now, this is the diagram actually used by Carl Jung in his own analysis. And it is an abstraction from another one that he would rather not publish, because if he did, he would have to confess the source. And in altering it, he's made it worse. This big circle represents the whole of your psyche or soul. He cuts it in half, slightly more than halfway, and shades the bottom half dark, except for this hole in the middle, which he names the individual, the real individual. Whatever you are really is inside, lit. Only you can't get at it, says he. Now, this top part here is the conscious part of your mind, and the outer band here is your personality, and these little circles represent objects which act upon your external personality. This is a whole zone of the consciousness. And consciously, you have a thing, the ego center. That ego itself is simply that to which you refer when you say I. And funnily enough, a thing that York himself didn't realise, it isn't the same thing for 2 minutes together. Because it's only a complex of conscious ideas, which change all the time. But he took it as a fairly stable thing. And it is the reference point when you say I in consciousness. Now, remembering our HM opposition, the spirit, light, consciousness, matter, dark, inertia, he cuts the circle in half and calls the whole of this part the unconscious. And yet he knows that this is like a water body reflecting the elements above it. So that for every element above it, there's one below it. And he translates certain archaic terms and gives them new names which don't help and rather obscure the real meaning. The ego's shadow, he actually calls it the shadow, in the unconscious is, in his terms, that aspect of yourself which you see in dreams as a little diminutive version of yourself, sometimes obsessed by great weights. You might have an idea that you're very, very little in a dream. That is your shadow self. It is the reflex of your conscious egoic self. Here is a band across the middle of your personal unconscious, and the whole of the rest of this is the collective unconscious. Now, this external personality here is, as far as he's concerned, simply the adaptation mechanism to your environment, reaction to objects and people who have stimulated you. This is your personal opinion of yourself, the ideas you've integrated that you like about yourself, and down there are the ideas that you don't like about yourself. This one says, I'm a really good guy, always keep my temper, except under great provocation. And this one says, I'm a petty, irritable little twerp, and don't want to admit it. This, which is neither conscious nor unconscious, from the point of view of the egoic centre, or from the shadow, is not discussed other than to say it is your individuality. Now, that personality there, band, shows you all the different ways you have of relating to other people. And it's opposite down here, he calls the anima, or the animus. Now, anima is Latin for soul, and animus is another thing, except that this one is male, this one is female. Now, the idea of Adam and Eve, Adam and Eve, consciousness and substance, appears in this diagram, and he says, borrowing it from the Bible and various other archaic religions, that every human being is a hermaphrodite, he's male and female. And therefore, if a man in consciousness exists, a being who says, I am a man, then unconsciously, he is a woman. And if it's a woman who says, I am a woman on the surface, she is a man. So she has, a woman would have an animus inside her that is a masculine side to her nature. And a man has an anima. Now, the source he gives for these two is the cause of a recent book he wrote about God, which got a very good hammering from the theologians and the critics, because it showed that it wasn't his real subject. His understanding wasn't big enough to deal with this. The collective unconscious, for him, is simply the totality of all your ancestral experiences from the primal substance, the protoplasm, say from the level of the amoeba upwards, so that every state of being, living being, is engrammed inside your physical tissue. And all those impressions are called the collective unconscious. Your personal unconscious, that which belongs to you, is simply that which the ego doesn't like to know about and has pushed down in here, or which you don't let anybody outside know about, so it's pushed down in here. So your personal unconscious is the zone of the things you don't want to be known outside about you, and that you don't want to know about yourself. But the collective one is the totality of all the things, all the predilections, the desires, the ambitions of all your ancestors. And in the anima is the collective experience of all the men, your forebears, your male ancestors, the collective experience of woman, making a kind of Rider Haggard she figure. And in the woman, there is a collective being, the animus, which represents the totality of the experience of your female ancestors of males. So, we see an analysis which is very similar to the great religions about this male-femaleness, and then we see that it has certain elements that are not as well expressed as can be done in a diagram slightly different. So this means to say that inside every man there's a tendency to prefer one type of woman to another. And that preference for blondes or redheads or brunettes or short legs or long legs is not much to do with that individual. It has to do with the totality of his ancestors' experience of women. So the anima in a man and the animus in a woman has a dual aspect, because every wife or every husband has two aspects. One thing, the man to a woman is being tied to her by affection and being a breadwinner, and the other is he's always trying to get away from that restraint, and also he sometimes tries to dominate the situation. And a woman doesn't marry a man in order that he should rule her. So she has a double image inside her from all her female ancestors of the males as experienced by those female ancestors. And all this image is surcharged with highly delightful characteristics and very horrible characteristics. The tyrannical man and the perfect subjugated lover in the same figure. And the same thing with the anima, which is the perfect angel of a wife and an absolute horrid and nagging, naughty old singing horse antipathy. So these dots down here, which correspond with the external objects for the individual, correspond with the objects that the ancestors have seen and which have produced in your substance, in the germplasm handed down to you, images, just like the objects outside produce ideas in your consciousness. So that diagram is his way of looking at it, and yet it cuts the thing like this, and it doesn't show us what we'll see in this diagram. If we take this, there's your material gross body, we'll make it fairly dark on the edge, nice thick edge. There's your physical body. There's that exhausted centre of spirit, the immanent spirit, which he's marked as an individual, which is really a misuse of a term. And between that untouched paper there and there is no difference in quality or essence. The difference is that is inside this circle, and that is out. So we say this is immanent, that is transcendent. There's your physical body, which receives stimuli. Those stimuli produce ripples, and this centre is broadcasting light, or eternal commands. And between the two, there arises a zone of idling, and the egoic centre appears. Yeah, and we must go to the circle. It's not a good idea. That is your centre of reference, the focal point of your consciousness, your sense of I. And that centre is simply the resultant of forces from within, from eternity, and forces from time outside. Now, what comes in is assimilated to this if it is pleasant to it. And if it is not pleasant, it is either thrown out in an immediate reaction, you are told to go to blazes, or if that consciousness there, the egoic consciousness, dare not kick against the stimulus openly and doesn't like it, it pushes it down behind it. So this is the zone of repression, supposedly. That's this one. See? Now all the stuff that is pushed down there, some of it is not liked by your internal spirit, so it pushes it back. And you develop another idler here. It always occurs, there's always something sending something down, something sending it back, and the generation of an idler between, which would be another circle. Now, round here, there is a body which we can call the immortal. He's written individual there. Really, this is the immortal body, the truly individuated immortal body, round that immanent spirit. And that is the body that has to be perfected. So if the egoic center throws something down there, represses it, because it doesn't like it, the immanent spirit may like it very much for integrating it into this body. So it retains it in that body, and that one doesn't know about it. So you're preparing an immortal body, very often unconsciously. Now at the same time, certain demands are made from outside by stimuli, requiring you to behave in a certain way. And you feel the call, you will arrive at work at 7 o'clock tomorrow morning or something. Now you respond to that in certain ways, and you send a behaviour pattern into your physical body zone, and you back it up here with a little zone which represents the personality in this diagram. Again, it goes all the way around, I won't bother to draw it. This band is your personality zone, which you express to please external beings. And yet, you don't like it. So you just push it that way, you don't push any of that stuff backwards. But there are some other behaviours that you'd like to keep for yourself that you don't express. And there are also some behaviours you haven't found out yet whether they're worth you keeping or whether they're only good for a facade. So you have a zone there of testing, a testing zone for ideas that may be fit to assimilate into your egoic consciousness, or maybe only for facade purposes, like being polite to the boss. The ego centre itself has exactly the same thing. It rejects certain things, and those things are refused by the immanent spirit. So we get a series of circles all the way around, and the stimuli are all around this being, and this diagram then becomes arbitrary. And it's much simpler to think about the relation between your immanent spirit, which is almost pushing up, welling up from inside spontaneously, and knows more about anything than you could possibly learn by this external stimulation. And yet, the fact is that that external stimulation exists. So there is friction. There are other beings here with teeth biting you, stimulating you. And of all the stimuli, some of them are acceptable to make an immortal body and some are not. Those that are rejected are thrown up to be expressed. But the ego centre dare not express some of them, so it pushes them back. So you have this zone between your immortal individuality and your egoic centre, and between that zone and this one there is a testing zone where the ego itself is continuously represented with ideas that it has repressed in the past, but they keep bobbing back again because the immanent spirit won't have them, so it keeps throwing them up. Now it's this stuff that's thrown up from below that's persistently pushed back, that is re-thrown up, that produces what we call insanity. You see, insanity means unwholeness. Sanity is wholeness and nothing else. If for certain external situation values this egoic centre pushes back certain tendencies, like the tendency to express yourself freely, well, this says I'm only interested in expressing myself freely, so it pushes them back. The ego is terrified of some of the things that occur to it to say. said in English court of law. So it has to push them back. So there then is developed, below the level of the ego, but external to the immanent spirit, a zone of terrible compression of energy. And this zone is the zone that the psychologists are trying to get at. It's full of elements that your immanent spirit won't have anything to do with, because they're only external bendings of the knee, and your egoic centre dare not express because it would lose its job, or its girlfriend or something. So if you compare this rough sketch with this one, you'll see that that is actually a superior diagram to this one, because it gives you the dynamics of the internal-external relation. And in fact, actually all modern psychology denies that that immanent spirit is aware of itself. They can't deal with it, because if they allow it to exist, it is the same as that. If that is being awareness, sentiency, so is that. And if that is so, then no egoic purpose can triumph. But the zone of ambition is not down there, the zone of ambition is here. So all individual ambitions cannot afford to believe that immanent spirit and transcendent spirit are in contact, and that the ultimate battle goes always to this. So that this whole zone here, which we call the zone of the law, the Torah, in the body, the turbulence of the spirit, the zone of the groaning and travailing to be delivered, all that is a zone in which we can never win. No matter how hard we try, if our purpose is other than the one that immanent spirit, transcendent spirit have. Now, have we got any questions that we might deal with arising out of it?
Well, in that drawing there, you spoke last week of intuition,
yeah,
and psyching.
Yes.
Now, I take it that intuitional thought is coming from the immanent centre.
Yes.
Now, these things that you're speaking of, such as the ego and the heart, are the things that are pure that.
Yeah.
Now then, you also spoke about when you were talking, you said that in between talking you did not think.
Yes.
Now is that stilling all that part? Is that the stilling of all that part?
All this stands still. Until you train yourself, all this is turbulating like this. It's going like this all the time, so that one idea is chasing another one.
Now, that has a very close relation to what you were telling us about with the fool, has it?
Mm-hmm. You see, the gaining of that stillness is the same thing as becoming a fool consciously. Because when that turbulence is going on, it's very clever. It's that that thinks exactly what to say that will wound so-and-so, because he wounded me last week. That mercurial quickness that allows you to defend yourself immediately. That's all turbulence. The Burmese word for that is turba, you know, turbining process. Now, this is very important, as he defines, in the German language it's wonderfully thick, but he defines this relation internally in such a way that he says this is the devil's zone. You see? Not that. This is the devil's zone. The whole world lies in the grip of the devil. Every finite, every gross material body is in the grip of the devil. And he says, the devil and his authority extend no farther than anger. No farther than anger. Now, if you look at the word anger, we'll see why he said it. The German word for it, if you like, is angst. And it really means fear. Now, anger never occurs unless you're afraid. It is evidence of fear. It is also evidence, you see, Gär. This Gär at the end is the same Gär in German, you know. Gear means your earth is breaking up. This is your serpentine nature, your cleverness. This is your growth body. This is your disintegration tendency. So people shake with anger. And they actually disintegrate their organism with anger if it persists. Now, have I got any questions that we might deal with arising out of it?
Well, in that drawing there, you spoke last week of intuition,
yeah,
and psyche.
Yeah.
So I take it that intuitional thought is going from the inner centre.
Yes.
Now, these things that you're speaking of, such as the ego and the heart, are the things that are dealing with that.
Okay.
Now then, you also spoke about when you were talking, you said that in between talking you did not think.
Yes.
Now is that stilling all that part? Is that the stilling of all that part?
All this stands still. You see, until you train yourself, all this is turbulating like this. You see, it's going like this all the time, so that one idea is chasing another one.
Now, that has a very close relation to what you were telling us about with the fool habit.
Mm-hmm. You see, the gaining of that stillness is the same thing as becoming a fool consciously. Because when that turbulence is going on, it's very clever. It's that that thinks exactly what to say that will wound so-and-so because you wounded me last week. That mercurial quickness that allows you to defend yourself immediately. That's all turbulence. The Burma's word for that is turba, you know, turbining process. Now, this is very important, that he defines, in the German language it's wonderfully thick, but he defines this relation internally in such a way that he says this is the devil's zone. Not that. This is the devil's zone. The whole world lies in the grip of the devil. Every finite, every gross material body is in the grip of the devil. And he says, the devil and his authority extend no farther than anger. No farther than anger. Now, if you look at the word anger, we'll see why he said it. The German word for it, if you like, is angst. And it really means fear. Now, anger never occurs unless you're afraid. It is evidence of fear. It is also evidence, you see, gear. This gear at the end is the same gear in German. Gear means your earth is breaking up. This is your serpentine nature, your cleverness. This is your growth body. This is your disintegration tendency. So people shake with anger. And they actually disintegrate their organism with anger if it persists. With suppressed anger, you can produce every organic disease you care to think of. Because every disease is located in the psyche in relation with certain ideas, and every idea with a function, and every function with an organ. Specialized. So if you're angry about a certain subject, you act upon a certain organ. And it begins to disintegrate. This is why Christ said, be not angry with one another. This anger is simply the contraction of this zone, egotism, you see, this ego centre, grabs hold of the whole body to use it, and then it thinks very rapidly how to defend itself, and what to say, and what to do. Then the whole of the nervous energy flies around the body very, very rapidly, and you feel your temperature going up. And very frequently, while you're doing that, you're going pale on the outside, because all the blood is diving into the muscles ready to hit out. Going pale is not a sign that you're not going to do something. It is a sign that your blood and your energies have internalized into motor departments to hit out. So, this turba, or turbining process here, when it is going very, very fast, he calls it the Mercury, not Mercury. When he calls it Mercury, that means it's gentle. When he calls it Mercury, It's going to mar everything. Break it all up. Mars. If we can stop this process, then this light, which is issuing, shines. And when he said that the devil's authority extends only as far as anger, he meant to say that you contract yourself and stress your gross body and tighten yourself up and make your nervous fluid fly around your body and animate your brain tracks so that you can get plenty of ideas to hit the enemy. That then you are in the realm of disintegration, which is devilish, the div or dividing function. Then you are no God to yourself. You're destroying your unity. So if in fact you can relax and understand that when you're angry you're doing yourself profound disservice, and relax and say it isn't worth murdering myself, because anger is murder. Actually, murder. If you're angry a little bit, you've murdered a little bit of your tissue. Good night.
Good night.
One of the things that I was having very difficulty when I was thinking about this idea of enlightenment and intuition. When you were talking about the fool, he plays about. It wasn't that something to do with finding out his purpose, the purpose of his eminent spirit? And when you still yourself, when you're speaking, are you doing the same kind of thing? Are you just letting it come through without any...
Without any criticism at all?
Yes.
You risk the consequences.
That's what I mean. You've got to just let it come. You don't have to...
Well, he doesn't consider it.
You can't consider, you see.
If you consider it, then you're not being what you should be, open.
No, you're only just saying what comes then, aren't you? You're not issuing it, really.
You see... Remember, this zone behind the ego is a repressed zone of rubbish that's been rejected from there. Do you know that's the first stuff that starts coming up?
Yes.
Yes. Long before you get a pure intuition, you get a lot of rubbish, repressed stuff.
Which is fantasy.
Which is fantasy.
Yes.
If you express that, it'll say some very strange things.
But you've got to get it out.
But you've got to get it out.
That's what I'm after, yes.
But you've got to get it out.
That's the way to deal with it, to get it out.
Yes. What you have to do, the simplest way to do it without annoying other people, is this. You just start being honest with yourself. As simple as that. Start being honest with yourself. Somebody comes along and they say, "Hello, how do you do? Nice to meet you." And instead of you saying, "Nice to meet you," if it isn't, you don't. You deliberately look round for something else and say, "Well, it's a blue sky today," if it is. You see that? You divert yourself and your energy out of the mechanical process. And you determine you'll be perfectly honest. You don't have to injure anybody outside. The stuff will then begin to appear in your mind. And you will understand what it means to be sincere. That is, to kra, to break off all the rubbish from you. The sin is separation. You've got to take the crust, the hard shell that's round you, and get rid of it. You can't do it without internal honesty. And you don't have to let anybody else externally know what you're doing. The man says to you, "How do you do nice thing?" You don't look at him and say, "I don't like your face either." See, that is a thing that occurs to you. That isn't an intuition. That's a repressed judgment that previously you dare not allow yourself even to think about, because it might show on your face. Now you allow it to appear, you just watch it and say, "That was the best selling part." Meanwhile, you're saying, "And there's a lovely pine wagtail going over the ground at the moment, avoiding that Rolls Royce." Yes, there is one. And you don't fabricate things in order to make comments, you just see what is and make a true comment.
It's got to come out by talking.
Well, you talk to yourself internally, you don't have to talk to anybody else. But they will require you to say something, won't they? If you just look at them and they say, "How do you do, lovely day in New York?" And start meditating on the processes in your mind, they'll say, "You're not all there." And you won't be all there where they are.
was something else that I was having a bit of trouble with as well. When you talked about helping someone that was ill or anything like that, you think you could actually give them a helpful stimulus.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things that I wondered about was for what period, only for the period that you're in contact with them, or whether you could continue that.
Well, do you know anything about hypnotic suggestion, post-hypnotic suggestion?
No.
You can hypnotize a person, and you can say to that person, in 3 years' time, to this day, at precisely this time, you will suddenly say, I must buy myself a red handkerchief. You see? And then you say to that person, under hypnosis, when you wake up, you will not remember anything about this suggestion, but you will execute the command. You wake him up, he doesn't know anything about it. At that precise moment in 3 years' time, you will suddenly speak. Because what you have done is you've stressed something that was eternal. Namely, it was always possible for him to say that, wasn't it?
Mm-hmm.
He just selected one of his possibilities and stressed it. So it's continuously working. So in the same way, you can continuously help someone, if you wish. You can allot a stress if you want. You say, I hereby allot stress X, PR, whatever it is, on so-and-so forever. See, that stresses it permanently. But if you said, I will help him for 5 minutes, you haven't defined the limit.
Yes. I was trying to get the idea of the faith or the flow of energy into the pattern that you have laid down, the concept that you've got.
Yeah.
And this living in the now idea where each new situation you're meeting on the instant, it would appear to be that when you've passed from the presence of that person, you're meeting the new idea and you've forgotten about that one. Now cease to operate the faith, allow the energy to flow into that particular concept that you had during the period that you were with the person.
Well, it's a very funny thing, you see. If you stop this tear-binding process, you do not forget anything. And you do not specifically remember it. It is all of it simultaneously available. The concept of forgetting and remembering is dualistic. It belongs in this process. Forgetting is just departing from one zone of your organism. Certain functions are in certain parts of the subtle body, which is linked with your gross brain. If you damage certain parts of the brain, certain functions are made impossible, although they exist in the subtle body, because you haven't got the mediator to the gross nervous system. They're still there. And it would apparently be that the process was going on and you couldn't express it. In the same way, at the gross level, you may remember something, you come across it, there it is, it's an intersection in your brain. And then it plays over it and it lights up. And then having gone over it, it passes and you've forgotten about it. After a certain revolution is re-stimulated. Anniversaries, Christmas and so on, Christmas shopping, Easter. These things are in your tissue now. They remember themselves according to psychic law.
How would the time factor work in the case you gave us then where you say you will buy a red handkerchief in 3 years' time? How would it be regulated to 3 years?
No, because the fellow has a calendar inside him. You stress something if it exists. You know, there's a very funny thing called biological time. Biological time exists in every living being. It's got a pulse in it. And it can get you up at any hour of the morning you want to get up. You can say, before you go to sleep, well, I'm going on my holidays tomorrow and I've got a train to catch. I don't need to fight myself like I do when I'm going to work. I'm going to wake up at 4:30 tomorrow, by the way. And at 4:30 you wake. Why? Because you've got a clock in you. There's a clock. This biological clock is very funny because in certain conditions, when you're a bit feverish, it goes a bit quick. When you're depressed, it goes a bit slow. But the mean for the year is related to certain solar impulses. by the number of breaths that you breathe in and out in a year is related to the available energy in the solar system. If you breathe very, very fast on purpose, you'll have to breathe slower later.
It's biologically that the time is changing in
its aspect. Oh, yes. You see, you've got two kinds of time. Yes. Abstract time, which we measure on the face of a clock, and biological time, which makes things grow. Time is a being. It's not an abstraction. Yes. If you put a seed in the ground, it changes. On the Monday and the Tuesday and the Wednesday and so on, it isn't the same shape. It's not just 12 o'clock Monday, 12 o'clock Tuesday, and the seed's the same. It has altered. Processes are taking place in this biological time. Time is really a living process. Be careful you don't forget that fundamental sentience here, which feels a necessity for this impulsation. And it's this impulsation that creates time and produces formal modification through time. Europe tends to think of time as an abstraction. Oh, it's just time. What's time? Time is a real substantial being evolving. Saturn, Cross is time. You see, Saturn and Cross are the same. And time eats the children that it gives birth to. That is to say that time gives birth to a seed, to a flower, and it corrupts and becomes manure. And that real being eats that same manure to make another flower. It is not an abstract being, it's a real being. There aren't any beings other than real beings. You see, the whole mind has been so badly educated, deliberately, that you cannot think except in abstract terms, unless you work very hard on yourself. And when you think truly, concretely and absolutely, then there is no external authority for you. It doesn't matter who it is. Because you've got that same light. The light that lights every man that comes into the world is there and is equally binding everyone. It doesn't matter whether it's Hitler or Mussolini or the Queen Mother or whatever it is. If it says, I command you so-and-so, you say, even a Quaker would say, there's an inner light. I don't have to take any notice of you. And as you become more concrete and aware that sentience is the background of the whole universe, you can call on it on the inside. But you have been trained to be afraid, trained to panic when you see a uniform, trained to panic when you hear the trumpets blow in a high court, trained to panic when you see that wing and that furious face and the gouty leg and so on. It's all conditioning your reflexes, this training process. And you must release yourself from that by real concrete thinking. Purna is the Sanskrit term for the universal concrete whole, not the abstract whole. And that concrete whole has everything you could possibly imagine in it simultaneously all the time. Yes. Yeah.
I've seen that positive nothing experiment.
Yeah.
And I've also read of the degrees of depth of it.
Yes.
Can you tell me on the diagram where they're working, what they work on?
Well, of course, the deepest hypnosis can't go any farther than the limit of your individuality. It can't go into there, because that is absolute wakefulness. You can't hypnotize spirit. You see, hypnosis is only a method of putting to sleep, that is, rotating energy in a zone so that it can't escape. Hypnosis is a deep sleep. And all you do is you fix the attention so that the available energy goes round and round and round and round. It can't break out and make an association. If it could break out, it would wake up. Hence the fixation of the gaze. If you put an object just slightly higher than your normal vision, you'll quickly tire the eye. And it will tend to droop if you add to it verbal suggestions. And there are other techniques too. Then that person is monoideistic. You've really put one idea and stuck consciousness going around it like that, and he can't break out. It's fascination. And you can't go deeper than your individuality. Now, it's going on in advertising and propaganda in minute degrees all the time. People are being fixated, as they call it these days,
on an idea which then becomes determinate.
It makes us feel very mechanical when you see a film. I was high school when a certain piece of music was played, the man in the audience would stand up and shout out.
That's right, yes. Well, you know, really there's hardly any limit to the number of people you can hypnotize simultaneously.
Oh, so that's true.
You see? As a matter of fact, some of the things that can be done, I did a series of demonstrations on one occasion where different members were allowed at their own request to travel mentally, as they called it. Some of them called it astral travel because they were theosophists, to places to see if they could see what was there. And they described exactly the contents of places which were verified by other people in the audience. And they themselves were delighted because instead of letting them not know what was going on, they were brought forward into their so-called waking state, which is really a sleeping state, very gradually, so they managed to retain the memory of what they had seen. And it profoundly altered their attitude to their existence, because they discovered a funny thing, that there is no reality distant. Distinct is two touchings. To distinguish is to put two fingers instead of one like that. And in the concrete whole, which is fundamentally a continuum, there is no near or far. It is all simultaneous. So there's no travelling, really. There is merely a shift of attention, a tension, just like you can contract that, or contract your toe or something. How do you do it? You shift your attention, and there then occurs a physical tension in the body correspondent with the psychological attention.
That continuum would be Jung's collective unconscious, wouldn't it?
No, his collective unconscious is far smaller than that. Because this includes the absolute. And it includes the absolute as this threefold being awareness motion. And if Jung had have seen that properly, he would not have written what in effect was an atheistic book. And he wouldn't have been so depressed by his own idea. Freud never got near it, you know. And therefore he was profoundly pessimistic. And Jung differed from Freud only, really, on one major aspect. And that was this concept of whether psychic energy, the libido, which is simply the word love, disguised, lib, lub, libido, or psychic force, for Jung, is general. It runs through everything. And for Freud, is merely sexual. That's really their fundamental difference. So when he said it was general, he already invoked the collective unconscious, which Freud denied. But it was still a collective. Now, a collective is still made of parts, isn't it? It isn't the continuous absolute. It is a collective. You still got in that diagram those little dots down here, the elements of the collective, not the continuous, unconscious. So it's a concept added up from percepts of your ancestors, isn't it? It isn't absolute awareness that he started in, it's your biological predecessors' experience involved into your germplasm. Now, it happens to be true that that experience is involved into your germplasm, but that isn't the ground of it. The ground of it is absolute. It's far bigger than any collective.
That's ancestor perception still
limited, isn't it? Oh, very, very much. You see, he wouldn't allow, for instance, that a person could have in his unconscious the psychic content of a living lizard, say a Komodo dragon, which lives now. That couldn't be in your unconscious because your ancestors didn't experience that one. Now in actual fact we can contact it. Because it's within the absolute sentience and we can pick it up. Find out what it's like, where it is. It's possible, if you were to pervert yourself, to find out where all the treasure in the world is hidden and go and dig it up. he has to be very quiet because he has to cap off most of it to the government. That's it.
Decide then that you could
recover a former incarnation. You can recover whatever you had, absolutely. Because what you call previous incarnations are only previous stresses. And they're still there, only less intense. They're with you. Actually, they're marked on you. Your whole form is marked with your experiences. All you do is stress something you already have. You can't stress what you don't have. You can't ring a bell you've not got.
This may be an absurd thing to say, but from what you have said, could you be one of your own ancestors, actually?
Oh, yes. this is one of the biggest things you have to be careful about, because you might behave in a certain way, very, very badly, and then give birth or father some children, and later on you may be yourself the recipient of your own naughtiness by being born in your own line. Now, the only way you could avoid that is not to have any children at all. And then you might get stuck in a cousin's line or something like that. Who's worse than you are?
In another reincarnation, would you have a choice? Would you be able to say, well, I didn't like that family last time, I'll go to another one?
Well, that depends entirely on reflexive subconsciousness. You obviously have no choice unless you are aware of your being. It's just becoming aware of the content of your own being. No being can know anything other than its own substantial modifications. Can you see that? So you have to become aware of your content now. You don't know it, but there are millions of images derived from before this gross material world was precipitated inside you. Only they're dominated by the external stimulus at the moment to which you are paying attention. If you ignore the conversation and introvert, you'll start going back. Ideas will still be there. Ignore those and go back. Ignore those and go back. You'll come to the very substratum of your being, namely absolute truth. To do it, you must stop this external reaction, this curiosity that kills the cat. Cat is Greek, yes?
I personally can't say. The necessity of reincarnation when you have ancestral memory. I mean, it's the one thing I get bogged down on is this reincarnation. I can't actually accept it.
Well, it depends how you understand it, you see. When you say I, you are not referring to the same group of ideas every time. You know that, don't you? Because sometimes in a good mood, sometimes you're not in a good mood. And when you say, I am in a good mood, and I am in a bad mood, it's not the same I. Now, the consciousness as such is absolute. That awareness belongs to no body. Bodies belong to it. Bodies are internal to consciousness. Now, incarnation is simply stressing in a body. Actually, you don't know what is incarnate in you now. You don't know how many things have incarnated in you now, because different things incarnate in you from moment to moment. That is, they embody themselves in your action. Now, until you can gather yourself together and integrate yourself so that your individuality is indestructible, you cannot consciously take over the body. But it's actually possible for an integrated person to incarnate in another body's body, in another person's body, so that he's using two bodies at the same time. Actually, this happens sometimes when a very strong-willed person persuades a weaker-willed person to do something that he shouldn't do at all. And it's the incarnation of the strong will into the weaker body. You see, incarnation itself requires very, very careful thinking about. It isn't a slap-happy idea that you have a formulated soul that knows what it's doing, that at death goes out and looks for another body. There's not one person in a thousand has any possibility, never mind actuality, of integrating themselves to the point where they could choose where to go. People don't choose where to go as it is in their physical body on earth. They are reacting all the time to suggestions from outside. So, to understand incarnation and reincarnation, first of all, you have to get hold of that integrated center, which is the only thing that can be said to reincarnate. You see, if you look at the parents of some children, you see factually characteristics in the children that are in the parents. You can only say that those characteristics have reincarnated in the children, can't you? That's the whole meaning of heredity. That there's reincarnation of character, re-embodiment. Those bodies will be finished with, the character will persist, it has reincarnated. But reflexive, self-conscious reincarnation is the rarest thing in the world. Yes, I know. People often get puzzled about that, but really, until you're reflexively self-conscious, to talk about reincarnating yourself is meaningless. First, you've got to gather yourself together and be sure that you're you. How many people can know that they are themselves in the middle of deep sleep? Not many. And yet, as a matter of fact, the state of deep sleep, at its very deepest, carries problems with that. That is to say, in the very, very deepest sleep, you are omniscient. And when you begin to move from the depths forwards into the dream, that's fantasy. And as you move through that, the fantasy becomes fixed, and you call it waking up. The fixed fantasy is the external material world.
Well, how far removed is trance
from? A considerable way. If you're talking about the trance that's induced by a hypnotic technique, because in sleep you are not monoideistic, you're not tied to an idea as you are in the trance. If your trance itself tells you it's trance, you're locked up. Now, in this very, very deep sleep state, you're not locked up. There's this transcendence here. You're face to face with the absolute there. That's why you cannot remember it. You cannot remember it because it isn't finite. All you can remember, make again a member of your waking consciousness, is form. So that the greater significance there is in a dream, the harder it is to remember it because it's wide. It's not defined down to particulars.
The strange point there, if in the very deep sleep we're closest to that centre, and yet in the sense that we're mechanical and we've got to wake up in order to get to the centre, we seem to be going two opposite ways to get to the same place.
Mm. Well, you are, actually. You see, first of all, you've got to see that external world objectively. Because you remember that when you see a thing, there's your eye, there's an object, there's the brain centre, there's the occipital centre at the back of your head. Some light shines on this, goes in the eye, carries a motion along the nerve to the occipital centre and registers the object. Now, if you could stop there, all you'd see is a prime percept. You could not say that is a box. In other words, you would not recognise it. But up here you have the type box, Plato's ideal box. Some people think it's just a lot of boxes you've seen before. But, whatever it is a box. It contains square boxes, tall boxes, long boxes, round boxes, and so on. That after motion there, which appears as a box, is fired up there, and stimulates its correspondent up there. And then a reaction starts back, and goes like this. So that what you see out there is not the box that is there, it is that box plus all the associations of your higher memory centers. They are then projected out and cover that box up.
May I ask? Yeah? Trying to absorb these ideas. We know there's great energy locked in matter, don't we?
Mm-hmm.
Now, this is an energy system, this rotating sphere.
Yes.
What sort of energies are there? Are they the same order of energy, or are they as powerful, less powerful?
They're the most powerful. Well, they're absolutely powerful. The first determination is universal power, and if you reduce that down to a very, very low level, you've got the H-bomb.
because the H-bomb is still gross. And the gross is the most inertic, least powerful of the whole system. Science hasn't finished. Science is going to frighten itself to death yet. Because there are forces that it knows nothing about. Far different from the electronic level. Nothing to do with what is called physical size. And already some of the most advanced scientists are aware that there's a real danger of breaking out of the material world into another world. Of a totally different order where the physical laws no longer hold. And that other world is far superior in power, and it is the source of our ideas. And it is those ideas that push around, those little brain cells that push around, push the muscles, that push various external metals and so on, and produce an H-bomb. You see, that which is most scorned is the most valuable, namely the invisible.
You know, you spoke of fission and fusion.
Yes.
And the idea for us. You could liberate very great energy
there. Right. The whole universe is such an energy structure. In ultrasonics now, they're learning a very strange thing. That the hardest thing they can find, and the toughest thing they can find, caves in on the stimulus of sound. And yet sound is what? The same order of stuff as a human voice, only raised up octaves higher and higher and higher. And at the top level frequency, it is so powerful that it can totally destroy the grossest matter and leave no dust, and there's no audible noise at the human level. There'll be no sweeping up in some war in the future when they've perfected ultrasonic techniques. There'll just be a general dispersal of the parts of the bodies of the armies.
You know that the sonic band is low, isn't it?
The sonic band is very low. You see, even light today is not considered the top speed. It's only considered the top speed for the material universe. And they're already frightened that they're likely to tumble through another kind of barrier, like the sound barrier, in the light barrier. Because there really is such a barrier. And many strange things happen when they break that. Because there's just... Pardon? The light barrier. Mm. I mean, to accelerate a body up to 186,000 miles per second is to stop it being a gross material body, and it's then light. If you say it's a photonic body, in order to exist at that speed, it must be light. That is the top speed for the gross material universe. But it isn't the top conceptual speed.
Trying to think about these ideas, you begin to see that all the powers are there, but they are locked that way.
Mm-hmm. Well, you see, the historic evolution of the world, the slow, bit-by-bit exposure of knowledge, goes hand-in-hand with a certain development of the brain and nervous system of the human being, because he's not allowed to have more power than he's really ready to assimilate. And therefore it depends on the evolution of consciousness in him, how much power is going to be made available for him. With another kind of power, he could say to the moon, remove yourself. You're 340,000 miles away, well, double it. You see, I want your periodicity changing, and it would move. And that movement would not be a shock. It would be spontaneous. Such are the powers that exist. And gross material powers are terribly crude. You see, supposing you take the lowest level of, say, in medicine, surgical operation on a bone. The bone breaks. You can't have anything much grosser than that. You put it together, then what happens to make it heal? You put the ends together and the cells start working. Why? If you say, I'll take some cells out and examine them, and you put them up, you heat them, you do all sorts of things with them, put them under the microscope, you don't come nearer to its intelligence. All you discover by that technique, which is SP technique, subject predicate technique, is that that thing is made of what you call chemicals, which are made of
electrical charges which are, at this very moment, becoming waves of probability in space-time. What's the meaning of a wave of probability in space-time deliberately knitting a broken bone? It's an abstract idea. That wave of probability is an actual wave. It's not a wave of probability, it's a wave of actuality, and it is intelligent. And the centre of a person there may actually send a message to break that bone in a so-called accident for the individual's good. Supposing a man is profoundly egotistic, and he's leading the whole organism into trouble, and he's digging to get power, and this thing here has another purpose. So it sends a message up saying, it's about time you fell downstairs, you know. So he falls. And then, when he's fallen down, instead of repenting, he says, everything's against me, I'll start again, where's my crutch? You see, the message comes up through the cells, don't heal. Don't heal. Go on annoying you. You cannot defeat that centre. That centre costs the insurance companies more money than any other. What the insurance companies call accident proneness is really internally willed. Yeah. This, the egotistic bias is causing fantastic errors. And therefore the only way you can avoid that sort of stuff is to find out what that really wants you to do and do.
Can you help me to try and understand this idea? Suppose somebody came here. People have talents in a certain direction. Suppose a man came here, not particularly a sound man, but he happened to have a talent in that direction. He thought, now that idea of fission and fusion of ideas, that's what I've been looking for. I can use that, and he can. He has an ability in that direction. What is the likely result?
Well, first of all, it's not correct if you're referring to his individuality and say that he can. What it implies is that he has already been led to a point where the ideas in his individuality can assimilate those new ideas. Not he can. Those ideas are forms. Now, he hasn't yet got a reflective self-consciousness, has he? Which is the only real meaning of he doing things. This is why Gurdjieff kept hammering into Uspensky and others. You can't do anything because you're identified with your individuality. Your individuality is form, and form can do nothing except be form. Decision isn't form, it's free spirit. So, in effect, if he saw that idea, it would simply mean that some stimuli in the past, ancestrally, and on him individually,
and so informed him that these new ideas fitted like little cogwheels into the formal pattern there, and that might move him towards a higher level where he could be nearer to reflexive self-consciousness. But if he made the mistake of saying as an individual these are good ideas, I can use them, he will fail. What he ought to say is something quite different. He should say, if these ideas are any use to the universal purpose, let them fit into their appropriate places. I need them. You see? Yeah. Then they go, as Christ would say, into their own place. Whereas people are always trying to put them in another place, like Humpty Dumpty, misusing terms.
That is where the private purpose, for instance, could be fit.
Oh, yes. And if there is a private purpose, sometimes it is followed with success for a period because it is useful to educate some other beings from the point of view of the universal purpose. And when that is finished, it is removed. The apparent success of Hitler depended on the disintegration of Germany, didn't it? No Versailles Treaty, no German disintegration, no Hitler. But that didn't mean he was there permanently. He was there to produce a type of unity, then his work was finished. He identified with the situation, and then he tried to retain the situation. Now they're going to build up virtually a moral dictatorship. Now anybody who wants to realize that and says, all right, I'm going to go moral for the period, I shall write moral articles, or I shall do this, and then that will reach a peak, and it will go up to 12 o'clock, and after 12 o'clock it's going to start falling. You should get up at 11 o'clock. It's all at alert. It's like Joseph to the cycle. Alert means all work, doesn't it?
You look for the next one.
That's right. Jump off 11 o'clock to every 6 o'clock.
The text, my father works and I work, is that it?
That's right. You've got to make the two simultaneously. You see, this is the father. I work. My father works. I work. When Christ said, if I judge, my judge, if I judge for myself this thing, my judgment is not right. But if I judge from him who sent me, my judgment is right. And then he says that very funny thing, I do not judge, but if I do judge, my judgment is righteous because two establish it, and I am one, and he is one who sent me. And some people think that he's being a bit cheeky there because they're saying he has fabricated God the Father and given himself an external authority, which he is the authority for. He says, God the Father exists and is right, and he has sent me, therefore you must listen to me. But really, it's a metaphysical fact. If we analyse the nature of the absolutely free, we find that free power, sentiency, either does nothing or something. If it does something, it conditions itself. And it deals with the conditions. God so loved the world that he had to give something to it. What did he give? His only begotten Son. That is the light of his consciousness put inside it to rule it. That's either or. If he doesn't make a system of circumscription, he hasn't made a world and there's no value. If he does, he's made a finite structure needing a light, so he puts a light in it. That's the problem. Yes.
No. One of the things that occurs to me is if you are going to get the tail in the mouth, which is turning your own power back on itself,
yeah,
and then you're going to get your sex energy and transfer it to a different place, you're going to be a terrific power back quietly, aren't you?
Mm.
Are you going to get the necessary problems for you to require that power?
Of course you are. You'll move to where that power can be utilised.
You're still going to get your tasks.
Oh, yes. You need to worry if you get that task. Something will be found by him.
So I can see that you couldn't possibly relate a private purpose to that kind of force because it's too great, isn't it?
Of course it is.
That's the stuff that's all flowing out through you without normally, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And I can see that will crack you up unless you've got something to use it on.
Well, it's that force of flowing through people. When we look at the people, we say they're incontinent. Because they can't stop it. But if they do try to stop it, and honestly want to subserve its purpose, it will find them something to do with the energy of the say. And it will be much easier than the other job they were doing with such difficulty. It will be a higher job, an easier job. And the higher you go, the easier the job you do. Think of God's job, it just goes like that. No problem, is it?
It seems probably enormous, doesn't it? It seems to me that it must get harder the higher you go.
it isn't true, you see. If you study, say, a child learning the elements of arithmetic, it has a terrible time. And once you've absorbed those, you begin to understand a bit what it's about. It becomes easy, doesn't it? The first time you do algebra, it's terrible. After a bit, you get used to it.
Yes, but it seems to me that it's coming so near to that less sentimentality of the idea of having a different world, you know.
Oh, there's no danger. That isn't the slush end.
But is it that it's not as hard to do what the great responsibility?
There's a very great responsibility. Well, there's an awareness of that responsibility such that you don't abuse it. You don't even have to fight yourself to keep your mouth shut on certain essential secrets. True of any service. You see, once you've defined a point as a location without dimension and understood it, you've understood the whole of geometry, because it's simply an extension of that. Isn't it? You know, when you think about throwing a word away, think about it very carefully. What you're throwing away are letters of the alphabet. They have a meaning. Before you throw a word away, I think it's not necessary. Find out exactly what it means. If you can't deal with the literal significances at first, at least get down to the roots. The moment you see Lucifer, these we call them the light bearer, you know. A loose translation. Well, you know that lux is Latin for light. There's another word for light in Latin, lumo. That means smoky light. And his name isn't Lumofair, it's Lucifer. So he's not the smoky light when he's called Lucifer. And his name was Lucifer before that pall, veil, fall, covering over that essential secret. Therefore Christ says, O Lucifer, how art thou fallen? Satan says, self-crucified. And Lucifer is his title before that peculiar process of covering over. It's actually the most fascinating subject in the universe, namely the identity of polar opposites. How is it that God, the Father, has his main characteristic given in the Old Testament as a devouring fire? You see, he's an angry, jealous God. What does that mean? It's exactly the same definition as the devil. And gradually this definition of God gets cleaned up as you go through the Bible. Why? Because people are evolving. First of all, they have to behave like devils. And then when the blood gets a bit cooler, they define God again. You have to define God continuously, you see, newly according to your level of being.
When he's described as angry fire, doesn't that mean that if you break the law, you've got a terrible consequence?
Yes, but that law was generated by it, through it. You can't have this turbulation without heat, and you can't have light without incandescing matter. And you can't have matter without this primary ground. The first letter of God's name, the Yod or Jot, the Yotta, is simply that. You see, because if you didn't gather the absolute and make a point in it like that, and then compress it and grind it, it wouldn't incandesce and become light. Genesis says, let there be light, which means that there wasn't any. The earth, that's the substance of the universe, was without form and void. Darkness was upon the face of the deep. And then he said, let there be light. And he went and crushed the substance like that. And that's the diagram of that yotta, God's fist.
Oh, that was the
bit
that Lucifer did, wasn't it?
This God as creator is Lucifer. William Blake, when he saw that, he suddenly wrote down a verse and said that everybody on earth is worshipping the devil under the name of Jehovah, and they don't notice it. Because the creator is he who does that. You see? Always. You get a piece of clay, do you ask the clay if you go like that to it? Who the potter praying? Who the pot? You see? So you say, all right, but the clay is my substance. That hand is clay, and this clay hand models that other clay. Does the pot complain when I model it? Let it complain. I have the hand to model the pot, not the pot me. Nevertheless, I'm constrained by the deficiencies of the material to make a pot. You see? There's a reciprocal relation there. God the Father is the devil, because the devil is the divider, and to create is to divide. If I create two, there's one and there's another, so they're divided. The two grams. You see, gram. Gram is the German word for grave. Change the B to V, that's death. It was called Schicken Gruber. It was a present from the dead, from the grave. If you can see this essential identity, that which was open, Jupiter, and that which was closed is the same, essentially. And when it was closed, and produced this plurality, by closing in various places, we said that's the devil's work. But those people who know that both are identical, deliberately tell people not to do this. Don't hang on to your taxes. When you get a demand, pay up. And remember, the truth is mighty and shall prevail. Make your record correct. Then on the collecting end.
Well, the names Jupiter and Saturn, were they used in this sense first, or were they applied to the planets first and then borrowed for this use?
They were first used in that sense and then borrowed to apply to the planets.
Oh, I see.
See, the planets are used because of a certain relationship to the Earth. If you make the Earth central to the system, and then put rings around it, you see. There's a definite relation between the Earth and the planets. If you look at the Ptolemaic system and the universe.
One thing that struck me the other day was that the planet Saturn is the one with rings around it, and was Saturn chosen there because the rings show bondage?
That's right.
Bondage.
Yes, sir.
And Jupiter's the free one.
And you notice the names of the other ones outside, which were supposedly unknown to the ancients. In spite of the fact that very often they said that there were seven planets and two others, namely the sun and the moon, which makes nine. And the names of the other fellows outside are the names of abyssal things. Heaven, Uranus, Pluto, which is that pylon, or abyssal distance around the whole process. They don't name those things accidentally. They search the deepest mythic tradition.
Neptune.
That means the ruler of the universal ocean, doesn't it? Beyond that, there's nothing, is there?
So the names were used before they were applied to planets.
These names, which existed and were applied to the recently discovered planets, when I say recently, I mean within the last couple of years, you see, those names are in all the ancient myths. They've taken them from the Greek, but they exist in Babylonian and Indian and so on. Those names refer to this. Neptune is the great ruler of the seas. He has a trident, or three teeth, doesn't he? Which are this being, awareness, motion, the universal ocean. In that universal ocean, there appears a great pilot, a great piloto, who pollutes the absolute, doesn't he? In the first maculum, that first dark spot, It's called the great interjection, magically. The appearance of a formed system. And then that grinding itself round, in a process from which we get the word crater, this great mixing bowl, that great grind set its edges on fire, and that was heaven, light, a big band of light. And then that light radiating inside, very like this all the time, produced all the systems within it. And if you remember that diagram we did of these zones, here, from that one to that, and work out the opposition between them, it's a very good exercise. Put your physical body there, that's gross matter. Put the hole in the middle, or the immanent spirit. Put your first individuation, the egoic centre, your relation with external beings there, and work out how many buffers you need between there and there. And see if you don't come to the number 9 for the lot.
I was wondering how many that would limit to, because you could always make them smaller and put another in between. Even if you arrived at 9, you could say, well, I'll make these smaller and put more in between.
You know what happens? You see, if we try to put a body in between the moon and the earth, a planet, do you know what happened to it?
Well, yes, we'd upset balance.
It will, if the distance between the moon and the earth doesn't alter, it will fall either onto the moon or the earth. Because of the disequilibrium of their cycles. It cannot stay there. In order for it to stay there, the moon must retire first. The universe is expanding to make room for more moons. By which time, you see, that will be an earth. And this will be a sun, having been condensed. It has to move out. So if there are more bodies appearing in the solar system would disintegrate and become a series of solar systems.
That must apply to all the names of the elements.
Oh, yes. It isn't accidental that the elemental scale is made up of a series of octaves. You've got 13 octaves in the atomic scale, haven't you? In the natural atomic scale, ignoring isotopes and other molecules, 13 sevenths plus one, haven't you? Now, the same notes in music are related at audio frequencies to the vibrations of those atoms.
There's a clue in the
name. Oh, yes. Every one of them has the correct name. Their positions in the atomic scale are tremendously important. Because actually, you've got a key of what you ought to work on next. In that. It's such a big subject, and yet it's as simple as that diagram. And once you've understood that relation of the centre to a perimeter and the fact that energy flowing from a centre goes so far and then turns back, and that is your pi law, and the amount of energy in it is the He law. So the He law and the pi ratio functions together. The height from which you drop the stone is the force, the H value. The distance and the height of the ripples that result is your pi ratio function. So you can analyse the whole system in terms of those two ratios, power and space. The funny thing is that ideas are charged with power. There's a natural relationship between ideas such that the word dog has more power in it than the word mouse.
In the same way that elephants would have more power in it than dogs.
Not because of the size of it, but actually because of the meaning of it it has. You see, elephant itself is God reasoning and establishing. The elephant is wise because it is actually a precipitate of a certain kind of understanding, and that's what caused its nose to become so long and grew a finger on the end of it. You know how sensitive an elephant trunk is. Now that nose is the organ of dissemination. And elephants, in spite of their large bodies, are tremendously sensitive. In fact, they were so sensitive they were put in an elephant's body to stop their gallop of it. question, this is an polar opposition. If you become one-sided, you would not be a whole being because you'd be delighted with success in one field and you would never develop your wholeness.